Okay, so we will kick off again. We are here pleased to introduce Rich Daly, CEO of Broadridge Financial Group. This is our first year to have you at our conference and for KBW to cover the stock, so thanks so much for coming. And a quick intro to Broadridge Financial. I know it was interesting. It was kind of a new stock to some of our financial services clients, even though you're in the financial services space, as we were kind of rolling out coverage. Broadridge is a $4 billion market cap company. A lot of that has accelerated in the last few months. It provides investor communications, technology, communication solutions to banks, broker-dealers, mutual funds, and corporate issuers. You know, a big portion of the revenue is derived from processing and distribution, and it's really a market we feel that ye have locked down and just know so well. It's very kind of created some nice barriers to entry. You know, but I mean, we'll kind of kick off with the Q&A there, maybe on that, on the two main businesses. And if you don't mind, we'll kind of do a little bit more high level, of what it is that you do. Here for this forum and for this group, just because you're new to the KBW group, if that's okay. The two businesses, the distribution of regulated materials and the processing, you know, where's the biggest opportunity in each of those instances?
Sure. So we're actually very pleased with the market position of both segments right now. And what I share with people is, even though we have 150 products, you really shouldn't let that cause any confusion, because what we really have is we have two product groups. One's communications, one's processing. The major macro trends that our industry is talking about, with, I'll call it, a higher level of activity than ever before, certainly is outsourcing, or the new consulting term is cost mutualization.
Cost
mutualization.
Okay.
So, and we've been in the outsourcing BPO or cost mutualization business before any of those terms existed. So let's first talk about the processing piece. The proof point in terms of the opportunity for us is the transaction we announced in an alliance with Accenture, with Societe Generale, during our fourth quarter call in August. And what that enables entities to do is take advantage of Broadridge's technology, all right, with the Accenture army behind it, to come in both from the people side as well as the people behind the conversion side. So, and this right now is focused on the European, Asian, Middle Eastern, and Australia markets. Now, why is this such a meaningful opportunity for Broadridge? We felt very good about our market presence and processing overall in North America, and we had a very good global product, which is going to be the foundation of the technology for the Accenture Alliance. But outside of North America, our market coverage was not robust, right?
Yeah.
I would now say that given the Accenture army behind this, the market coverage in Europe, Asia in particular, but I'd argue the Middle East and Australia as well, is at least as good, if not better, than what we have in North America. So Accenture being also the go-to-market client to tee these things up, and for us to show up as the technical experts, really is the right role for us outside of North America. So that's a very big market. Accenture has sized it at a couple of billion bucks. We have a certain piece of the relationship. We're excited about Societe Generale. The people have already been taken over by Accenture. We're going to be converting the London technology in calendar 14 and the Paris technology in calendar 15. We're working on both simultaneously. There's more work to do in Paris. We have a pretty good amount of client activity in London already. So let's call that on the processing side the opportunity. On the communication side, there is still $20 billion in paper and postage that our industry being brokers, mutual funds, and annuities, that they still spend on paper and postage. We've proven that we can go beyond what the industry has been able to do, generally in the 12 to 15% range on average in full-service firms, in the proxy world, by taking out over 60% of the paper. The reason, the way you get people to give up paper is not to offer to plant a tree in their name. The way you get people to give up paper is to give people a better experience and a better value proposition in the digital world. So giving people static content to give them that they get in paper digitally makes it less convenient to look at because it was meant to be a paper document. So we're going to increase the functionality and the interactive nature of the content. But what we're very focused on is in our Fluent suite of products, okay, which will include the content activities as well. Just like we did in Proxy, we're going to make the experience an interactive experience related to that activity, all right? And we're also looking to provide them the information where they live their everyday lives versus asking people to go through life remembering 50 to 100 passwords to 50 to 100 websites. So we just announced on the 14th, all right, just last week, that we've entered into a relationship where with Amazon, okay, they're going to be investing to create an application on the Kindle, okay, as well as Amazon Web Services, that could be a place if people live their lives there every day, we could put an indicator that they have content there. So it would not be the actual information from the statement, but it would be an indicator and a kind of a federated model is what we're looking to build for our clients, that any of our clients could get to Amazon or ideally as we go forward, Facebook, Google, Apple, etc., through us. The indicator is out there. You click on the indicator that says there's a statement waiting. You seamlessly move behind our firewall if we're hosting it like we do for proxy, behind the client's firewall if they're hosting it, all right? And all the encryption would be built in into that indicator in a way that it would still meet our ISO 27000 highest level of data security standards.
There's a few things and terms in there. It's like, can you say client, you mean the broker?
Yes.
And the client, the person, the end user kind of touching on the indicator, you mean if someone's on their Kindle.
The broker's customer.
So it's the broker's customer. So they get a notification that there's a proxy to vote on, or either they just even get, like, if they want to check their brokerage statement, that's something, a revenue-generating event for you. If they click on that button, they go in and check their brokerage statement.
Right, because what we're going out there with is we're not looking to share the $20 billion. The bulk of that will remain the service, the broker, mutual fund, or annuities. But by creating a secure environment and giving them a strategy to enable them to get to that $20 billion, this is really the ultimate win-win, unless you're the post office or a financial printer.
Okay. So this is kind of an announcement with Amazon that they're going to invest with you to work on this. Like, has it rolled out with the Fluent product? Like, has it rolled out with any of your brokers?
Well, let's go back to something else to which I know you indicated to me you want to get to, which is this fits perfectly with our Investor Mailbox product.
Right, yeah.
Which is what the SEC calls EBIP, right, or Enhanced Broker Internet Platform. So the Investor Mailbox product, we have 16 clients live. We have 8 in the process of going live. And in terms of signing up for digital proxy just on the Investor Mailbox, the increased activity is anywhere between 50 and 400% in the retail wealth space. So that bulk of the remaining proxies that we're still going after, and that call it, you know, less than 40%, is tied to retail.
Okay.
Right? And so if you give people a tool that's an interactive tool and easy to get to and easy to use, again, we've proven that the world is going digital. I mean, the generations behind me, my kids will never own a landline.
Mm.
You know, my daughters both live in New York City, and they walk by the mailbox every day when they go into their apartment with no interest of seeing anything in there. Because anything of any importance that's coming to them isn't going to be in that box. All right? It may be a catalog, it may be something they can get to on the weekend, but there's no urgency in checking mail. All right? So what we've looked to do is with the Investor Mailbox product, that's what we brought down to the SEC 5-6 years ago to show them how we could raise investor engagement.
Okay.
Okay? They liked it enough to say to the New York Stock Exchange, come back with a rule proposal. Okay? And that got involved with the whole fee discussion and EBIT, but I'm going to use these words, I'm being sincere. It only took about 4.5 years to get this done. Okay? Because it's a complex regulatory environment. So we believe that the EBIT initiative, where the SEC is encouraging people to use technology, will accelerate the adoption of the investor mailbox.
Okay.
We believe that by creating this suite of activities, we're going to go with a better offering, working with our brokers on their website, with a far better offering working on channels that people live their lives every day in, okay, and allow the customer multiple choices on how they can get access to their content. And we're also going to make sure that the content that they're looking at online is better than static content from their former printed activities. All right, and in that regard, we believe we'll move financial services closer to the west, where the rest of the world has gotten to. Now, the reason that you've heard me say in the past that we only do financial services, so a lot of these things like the 4.5 approval rate, 4.5 year approval rate, and the adoption rate, we like financial services because it is the most important function that exists. You know, if something goes wrong where your neighbor finds out what your cable bill is and they know you have the sports package, it's not a big deal. Your neighbor knows about your financial activity, it's a big deal. People are very concerned about identity theft, and they're not concerned about identity theft because someone can hack into your Facebook page and see who your friends are, okay? They're concerned as it relates to your wealth, your activities, and the things related to that, okay? Financial fraud related to that. So by us have already proven that we're at this high level of data security,
right,
by us proving that we get the functionality and we get the reliability right, okay, at extraordinarily high standards, all right, we're very excited that with all these things in place, we're so well positioned, and we don't see anyone nearly as well positioned from our point of view to go and attack this $20 billion. The pieces that I just spoke to you is the first $2 to $3 billion, which is statements, conference, and prospectuses.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you. So there's two, you know, I think you're really clarifying the two growth areas within the existing businesses. And even the kind of standalone as they are today without the consulting projects, you know, what other kind of things can drive growth in those businesses? Because, yeah, Fluent and EBIB, they are kind of a longer term. You're not going to see revenue next quarter. You might see revenue next year from it. But, you know, help me think about the growth potential, the growth
absolutely
rate in those businesses.
So the reason I started with, in the beginning of, it's two product groups with 150 products. Well, if we were having this conversation at the time of the spin, it was about 70 products. Right? So, and people, including you, will say to me, oh, tell me about this new product. How much revenue next year?
Yeah.
And my answer is, well, you know, maybe 400,000, maybe 500,000, and you know, I see your shoulders drop, and because you're looking for that, you know, magical moment.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, when we were rolling out this product strategy, I used a money ball analogy, right? Which is, you know, there's not a single activity that I think is going to be, you know, snap your head and look at it, but they're all slow and steady and contribute. All right? And so in our existing products at Neve, we're comfortable that we're going to be able to achieve the growth of the 5 to 7 that we talk about. All right? And there'll be a tuck-in or two in there, but that's all part of our product analysis, which when it gets out of our strategy thinking, you know, is the best way to get into that space to build or buy, okay, related to that product. So the 5 to 7 within our control, not relying on markets to come back, is something that we believe is in that 150 products, and we expect that number to grow. When we look at the three macro trends, I don't think you should bank on revenue from any one of them in a meaningful way immediately, but I think you should be thinking, we're saying these three trends are going to drive more meaningful activity in terms of prospects, pipeline, and announced transactions than anything else in the 150 product set.
Okay.
And so if you take that as like an upside to what we have is what I call our journey to get to consistent top quartile returns, we really like where we're positioned right now.
Okay, fair enough. I guess on growth, and you know, if we could go back to just last quarter, for example, you put up some really impressive growth, and some of it we weren't quite expecting, kind of basically doubled what we were all expecting on your earnings. But you didn't change your full year guidance. you know, maybe part of it's being conservative or prudent, which is kind of, I think the terms Dan would use. But is, you know, is there that you kind of see a bit of an air pocket coming that you haven't changed your full year guidance now? I know it's typically 80% happens in the second half of your fiscal year, but still, that was a very, very strong start to the year.
And it's a great question, and we're in long dialogue internally. First, let me give you the situation analysis,
okay,
and then I'll come back specifically to directly answer what you just asked. The situation analysis is that on the activities that we planned on the activities we talked to you about when we announced last year's results and this year's guidance, those activities happened pretty much as planned, right? And if every announced plan happened that way, you know, I'll live a lot longer. The market activity is something we didn't plan. We actually last year, for example, on one small piece, which can yield significant bottom line activity, which was mutual fund, the venture and proxy. On the mutual fund, the venture and proxy, the gain year over year that we had between fiscal 12 and 13, we only included, and it wasn't a huge number, but we only included half of it in our number for 14.
Okay.
Okay? Why? Because we don't want to be burned on things we don't control. All right? We're all about controlling destiny right now. So in that 5 to 7, I'm telling you, without wind at the back, we believe we have the activities to get there. Now, market activity primarily hits our core products across the board. All right? So, you know, trades, particularly in any wealth side, are meaningful. Okay, because we get paid a lot more in retail than we get paid in institutional trading.
Okay.
There's no
okay.
books and record keeping required. There's none of that activity. Okay? Those trades generate confirms, they generate prospectuses, they generate other activity. Okay? So even though you look at trading activity as this global thing, and as the regulations make capital more difficult, we may see trading activity come down. The investors coming back, which doesn't offset trading activity, certainly for Broadridge's business model is far better activity.
Okay.
So there are two things that happened. We saw some increase in individual investor activity. All right. The other piece is if you add revenue to our core largest products, and you're adding it in what's a relatively fixed cost infrastructure, and there are some step functions, but they're pretty far and few between, the incremental benefit of that revenue is significant.
Yeah.
Okay? The incremental benefit of that revenue when we're already meeting our numbers within our control in something like the first quarter, added on top of that, causes this whiplash reaction, all right? And even that whiplash day we had where the stock went up at 6 and change and came down 6 and change in a couple of hours, which I personally could live without. So let's bring us to the next part of that question. So when I'm somebody who's looking to create a steady environment over a long period of time, okay, and I just issued guidance 90 days before that, and I'm going to be in 90 days subsequent to where I am at the end of the first quarter call with a far clearer view of what our year is going to look like, because it brings me actually 7 months into the year, and for the things that I can see 60 to 120 days out, which is either mutual fund activity or proxy activity, we can look a lot smarter after the second quarter call. And on the things that you're looking for me to say, well, is market activity going to continue or not, I would argue doing what you do for a living, you have as good of a view on that, if not better, than I have.
Mm-hmm.
So the term I used in the Q&A is the reality is we're not addressing it now. We said we're going to kick that can down the road another quarter because we can.
Well, it looks like none of us have doubled our forward numbers like the way you kind of doubled on the first quarter. And I know the second half of the year would be kind of crazy to do that anyway. But
well,
none of us, we've all kind of kicked the can a little bit.
Quarter activity.
Yeah, but
because if the same exact market activity happened in the fourth quarter, you're not going to see near the percentage change of activity.
Yeah.
All right?
Sure.
And so let's go back to what I said earlier. The journey is to create, get to, and stay on a consistent path to top quartile returns.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So having a, you know, blip here or a blip there is something I'm not looking to do. right? I'm interested in where the stock is going to be a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, you know, 10 years, and long after I'm gone,
yeah.
Okay, where it's going to be. I'm not particularly interested in days where it goes up $6 and goes down $6, and the people trading us didn't know whether we were in financial services or made shoes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so...
Okay, fair enough. I guess just one thing on, not just specifically that quarter, but we've had a couple of quarters now of the mutual fund activity picking up, and that does seem to fall a lot to the bottom line. You know, what would make you feel comfortable that that activity is kind of rebasing higher after so long kind of being below capacity?
And it's a great question, because statistically our work says that in terms of where the volume trends can be, call it a bell curve.
Okay.
We're still on the lower side of the bell curve.
For that particular
right?
revenue line.
But because after the crisis, the first year after the crisis, it actually masked our performance because it went up dramatically so high as a lot of the funds looked to restructure and get these things behind them.
Some of them closed.
Many funds looked to get out of being incorporated in the state of Massachusetts and move to Delaware, where there's more flexibility in going to market. And where our data previously showed that about 22 to 24% of funds will be need to go for proxy a year, historically, when we re-looked at it and we brought in BCG to help us analyze it, they came back and said, you know, it's more in the 16 to 18% range. The number one driver of this activity is going to be that your board wasn't approved by about two-thirds. It varies a little, but call it two-thirds. Of the investors, right? And the one thing I tell people is that no one's figured out how to stop mutual fund directors from aging, retiring, and or dying, okay? So we believe that over time that there should be more activity. We also know that the fund industry is still not where they want to be, and so if they can delay the activity by convincing a director who would prefer to retire not to retire, that may still be taking place. So the way we're trying to manage the events outside of our control, market activity, mutual fund event-driven revenue activity, is you will not forgive us if we pick a number, and even if it's outside of our control, don't get there.
Yeah.
So on the numbers outside of our control, we're going to be... ideally, you would use the word prudent, okay, but we're going to round down versus rounding up, okay? And I don't see that changing for a while. Let me give you one last piece related to mutual funds. Throughout the crisis, positions have grown 7, 8%, right? We just recently had a lot of activity, and people are talking, well, investors are moving from equity funds to bond funds, okay? Now, a lot of people... have done that, okay? But they haven't gotten completely out of the equity funds. So let's say I'm in an equity fund or two bond funds, and I decide, you know what? I really need to get out of the bond funds. I may take 50% of that money. I may take 90% of that money. But as long as any money is left in that fund, it's a position. And our revenue in the communications business is driven off of positions and transactions, not by assets under management.
Mm-hmm.
So in the simple example, for a fund family that has a customer with $100,000 and two bond fund positions, and they lighten both of those and take two equity fund positions, for that mutual fund provider, their revenue is flat, and for Broadridge, our revenue doubled.
Right. Okay.
So
that going on?
You know, we like, you know, the one thing that all of the talking heads do, they talk about diversity, and we absolutely know they're right, because diversity is really good for us. More positions, more things we get to process.
Okay, fair enough. I guess one of the things that we thought was really attractive about the business that you've built is the cash generation. It's been very steady. It's been, you know, even since the crisis, like, I mean, you spun out during the crisis, you've only grown the cash generation since then. And you've been making acquisitions and you've been buying back stock, so you don't need to keep a lot of cash on the balance sheet. You're not very capital intensive. So you just remind me, what are your priorities for the use of cash?
Okay. So we fundamentally believe businesses are there to create shareholder value. You know, that shareholder value should turn into cash, and we believe that cash should be returned to shareholders in meaningful ways that casts a wider net for more serious investors, okay, serious long-term investors. So from the time we spun, we established a dividend. At the end of every full year since we've spun, we've raised the dividend. We are now at an announced 40% payout, right? So priority one for the cash is to pay a dividend. Given our low capital intensity and our strong cash flow, there's no reason why that should not be something that we do, and there's no reason, and we believe that should make us attractive to a whole other set of investors. Growing and controlling our growth is a priority. So investing in Broadridge has been a priority. I've never found the people who have come to us and said, there's this company out there which is not performing as well as you. You're not in that business, but you should buy it. And I've never understood the logic of that, because we don't think we're smarter than the people running a business we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we're looking, and so the strategic tuck-ins, we're looking where we can use our very strong brand, you know, our 99% client retention rate, okay, our high customer satisfaction levels, and take a product that lots of our clients would be interested in if it was in an environment like Broadridge is, but in its current environment, they're really not willing to rely on that being there when they need it and how they need it. So therein lies the tuck-in philosophy. What we haven't deviated on is our desire to do tuck-ins. What we haven't deviated on is our two key criteria, which it has to make strategic sense, as in this is something we know how to do, and it has to make financial sense. So we've looked at hundreds of transactions that we either didn't meet our strategic criteria or we couldn't get the financial terms, right? So when I said, as we had built up cash because we didn't do transactions, and people asked, what's changed? My answer was, nothing's changed.
Yeah.
Okay, but being able to pull the trigger is going to be because it meets our strategic criteria and our financial criteria. We won't do a deal for the sake of doing a deal. When we built up cash, okay, we said, look, we want to use our strong cash flow to the benefit of our shareholders. And given our confidence in the future, it's very easy for me to believe we're buying back opportunistically, because we intend to be a greater value as we go forward. Now, fortunately for us, anything we've bought back right now is well in the money, all right? So, but our first choice and plan on it is the dividend. The next choice is to do the strategic tuck-ins. If that's not available, okay, we will consider, you know, the opportunities that we have in the pipeline for acquisitions versus the cash we have on hand. And, you know, we're certainly looking to offset equity comp dilution, although we may do more in one year versus another, but we'll signal that as we do that as well.
Okay, that's pretty clear. Thank you. Acquisitions. So you acquired for a while and you repurchased some shares. But talk to me about the environment. Do you think seller expectations are kind of getting closer to where your expectations are, maybe now versus a year ago? What's the activity level now versus a year ago?
The private equity buyers, if we don't have distribution advantage, if we don't have management advantage, are going to win.
Okay.
Because they get to lever up and I don't. So I'm looking for a 20% IRR, which for them, levered four times, is 80%. Their threshold is far lower than 80%, all right? So it has to be something that makes sense to us. We'll win when it's something that under our distribution channel we can plan on accelerated revenue growth versus what they're willing, where we have some cost synergies, where we have some management synergies. Those are the places where you should expect us to be focusing on. So I don't think the private equity market has improved or gotten harder, all right? I think it's there, and I'm planning for it always to be there.
Right.
All right? So financial buyers will always be there. We think we bring more value than other strategic buyers, even with our higher hurdle rate, because we think we have a very, very solid distribution channel. But that means if we're getting out into new spaces, right, even though it's within our markets. If we're not leveraging that client base, it becomes harder for us to do.
Okay. And then, you know, is there, I guess maybe there's not an outright preference, but it seems to me like maybe there's more opportunity in the SPS segment, this processing segment, to make some acquisitions and to expand more into the buy side there. And is that fair?
It's absolutely fair. There's a lot more, even though our largest segment is the communication segment,
yeah.
There's a lot more processing in the world than there is communications, given what a strong percentage of the communications market we have.
Right.
Right? So the processing segment had an additional hurdle to get over until we got to where we got at the beginning of last year, which was we were confident that both segments, including processing, would be contributing top and bottom line. We are particularly pleased with the management of this processing segment's turnaround, okay, which was very difficult to get through the crisis. Remember, Lehman was a customer, Bear was a customer. And even though those accounts went to another customer, the revenue we got from adding those accounts to another customer versus the standalone was definitely lower revenue. So we are open to more processing transactions. But there's a lot of neat stuff in the, you know, I'll call it communications-related space, Matrix being the largest deal we ever did. We felt that was as much a communications play as it was a processing play and put it in the communications segment.
Okay, fair enough. Cost management. You've tightened things up a little bit. You did a restructure after the pension thing was all done. The IBM migration is done. Should we be looking for more cost reductions from here, or kind of you think now you're in a good place where you are in the environment and you're kind of happy with the structure you have in place?
Broadridge's DNA is that we're very good cost managers. So
I've seen those gray offices.
So, we have a million square feet on Long Island at, five and change, which I think is still too high, but we just entered into a transaction with the state where we made it very clear that we would leave. This is public. And so we have certain tax abatements to stay in New York, which are absolutely appropriate because New York has to compete with other states.
Yeah.
So, but every business unit every year has to present a plan which includes how they're making their business more efficient, right? Technology certainly is an enabler there, and we've applied it consistently and aggressively. Beyond that, though, the processing business's leadership recognized that the old world of brokerage processing, we should not plan on coming back. And so they did more dramatic things as part of enabling that business to grow top and bottom line. What I actually announced was we're going to grow the bottom line to enable us to create value year in, year out, and we'd like to do it all through revenue growth. But if we don't do it through revenue growth, both business units all the time have cost management plans in place, all right? If I'm given a choice, I'd rather use those resources to invest in new activities, but we have the option, okay, if revenue doesn't happen at the degree we wanted, if we're confronted with a change in market environment, and I'm talking about not a financial crisis change, I'm talking about normal market changes, that we have the ability to achieve the results that we're looking to achieve by top line growth, by expense management, and then ultimately using our strong cash flow to create some TSR beyond that.
Okay. So I open it up for questions? Okay. You have one here?
Can you just talk about where you stand on the regulatory front with respect to the processing business?
Absolutely. So when I mentioned EBIT was passed, all of the open items on the regulatory side are now closed, and I don't believe there's any open regulatory issues that we're concerned about. Somebody said to me, so does that mean next week they're going to talk about changing fees again? And You know, the fee part of this change that came through with EBIP, which we also actively supported, that fee dialogue started before we spun in April of 07. So it's not something where if the New York Stock Exchange has to propose it and the SEC has to approve it, it's not something where it can happen quickly under any circumstances. That's why I said on the EBIT part, which was a four-plus year activity, all right, that's viewed as very quick regulatory turnaround. So we view, I was very clear, and even though most people in these positions said, but it's still a cloud, it's still a government, yeah. Who knows what's going to go on? You know, we've consistently viewed regulation as our friend because it's never just an economic issue. It's always a policy issue as well. And somebody needs to implement that policy and make it work, and somebody has to get paid for that. So we view these activities as being our friend. Not having that cloud over us and not explaining that for the first time in about 7 years feels pretty good, right? As we go forward, focusing on those three key strategic themes, as well as the new products that are newsworthy to share, is really what I'm looking forward to talking to people about. But I'd like to think for a reasonable period of time, and I'll let you all decide what that is, I'm not going to be in this regulatory dialogue conversation.
I'll ask one last, if I could. Why are you not more enthusiastic? Because the environment, you're always very enthusiastic. You choose to have a good day, so I'll just correct myself there for a start. But it seems like you're being very conservative in your guidance because the environment is changing. Fundamental investors are re-engaging. You benefit more when the retail and the wealth managers re-engage. The mutual fund managers, they've been kind of, there's opportunity for mean reversion back to activity because it's been so slow for so long. And, you know, I guess you did comment on the call that, you know, for the first time in a long time, capital raising is good and new company issuance is good because that means a lot more new stock positions. So it just feels like, yeah, maybe you're being quietly optimistic, but are you more optimistic now than you have been in a long time?
So I'll give you two reasons, which one is as good as I'm going to get to having you feel at least there's some basis for what the position we're taking, which is there have been a number of false starts that we've all seen, all heard in terms of the markets are now coming back over the last two or so years. Okay? So, but if you look at what I'm looking to do, which is to create long-term value, okay, let's say you're right. Where I ultimately get our shareholders to is the same place. Okay? Your approach gets them there faster.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I'm taking a long-term view. All right? And I'd rather keep people enthusiastic about the potential opportunity versus, you know, I've told them something's there that I don't have the ability to deliver within our control.
Right.
And now we create the next level of anxiety. So instead of regulatory clouds, I create the can they actually get to where we've created an expectation.
Yeah.
What I assure you is every day we get up and choose to have a great day, and in that process, we say, don't believe anything's going to happen unless we make it happen. And we're looking to fire on as many cylinders as one can possibly fire on with autonomous accountability in the organization of individual P&L owners, individual product owners, who my goal is to have a number of people be where I was when I was starting the communications business. It's the first thought you have when you wake up in the morning, and it's the last thought you have when you go to sleep at night. All right, so we believe in focus. But right now, we're pleased with the journey that we're on, and we think it takes our shareholders to a good place.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you very much, Rich. Thanks,
Thank
everybody.
You.